Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is your first time joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books as well. And in that journey, I discovered a fascinating pattern. There's a lot of businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million a year, and they struggle to break through it. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, founders, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their business to new heights so you can model those and do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting today. Our guest today is a leader in the healthcare technology space, driving innovation in medical coding, billing, and auditing. As the CEO of Inovi Health, Lamont Levitt has built a company that delivers industry-leading SaaS solutions, helping healthcare professionals streamline complex processes with efficiency and precision. Inovi Health is best known for its flagship platforms, findacode.com, hcccoder.com, metabrev.com, and qpro.com, trusted by professionals across the industry. Now, beyond the cutting-edge technology, Lamont has cultivated a company rooted in strong core values, including, get this, forward-thinking remote four-day work week. That is something we don't hear much anymore. With a deep understanding of the healthcare industry landscape and a commitment to both innovation and workplace culture, Lamont is here to share some insights with us today on leadership, technology, and building the company for the future that thrives. Lamont, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were talking earlier, and I love your journey because you kind of went down what we would consider a fairly typical path, did some college, got a corporate job, and did that for essentially your first career, and then left that and then started your own company for career number two. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about career number one. That was working with Novell.
Yeah, career number one, I was a mainframe programmer for Amoco back in the 80s. And then the whole 2000s, the big 18-year span working for the networking of the 90s and into 2000, where Microsoft and was competing against Novell for that whole networking post.
So we got to do some definitions here because some people are going to be like, what's a mainframe?
So big computers. That's where I started working on back in the, just out of college.
Isn't it amazing that like that capacity now is like what it's like 100 times that power is in your phone?
Yeah, it's crazy how it's evolved. Well, then there was a whole migration to everyone putting PCs on all their desks to get work group stuff done faster, and they needed to interconnect them all, networking, and that was that whole world I was in the middle.
So you were in the cutting edge of tech, seeing some insane advancements from mainframes to desktop computers to networking to this crazy thing called the internet.
Yeah. So crazy. The most important things I learned from being an employee for 20 years was actually from Ray Norda. He was the CEO of Novell. And he always told us time and time again, customers first, employees second, stockholders third. His point was take care of the customers first, because if the customers are happy, they'll keep paying us and you guys will have jobs and be happy employees. And if you guys are happy, then the stockholders would be happy because we're making money. So the root of all of that was always go back to the customer. What does the customer need? What do they want? What are they asking for? What are they going to ask for that we could maybe foresee or project? You know, you look at the Steve Jobs, you know, who would have thought, you know, he recognized what an iPhone could be, you know, or a handheld device before any of us knew we needed one.
Yeah.
It's that
famous Henry Ford quote, right? Where everybody said, oh, you need to ask the customer, ask the customer, ask the customer. And he said, if I would have asked the customer what they wanted, they would have told me they wanted a faster horse.
Exactly. So that's all they could see.
Yeah.
So when you listen to your customer, it's tricky, but if you can figure out what they're really asking that goes deeper, then that's when you can really make a difference.
You know, I love having these conversations with successful business owners and CEOs because of the fact that there's a core fundamental principle across every single business, and that is customer makes everything go. And I bring that up because I was in Hollywood for 20 years, and my mentor, he actually wrote a book called The New Art and Science of Filmmaking, how to fix the accidental industry. And he talked about this exact specific thing where they called it show business, but he said 98% of the people there have no idea about the business part of it. And so when you get into there, there's everything, it's just chaos. And so I bring that up because what's the fundamental thing of a business is you make your customer happy. And I could go off on diatribes about this last 10 or 15 years where you're like, what is Hollywood? Like, who are they making these movies for? Because everybody I talked to is like, I don't get it. So how did that show up then in the work that you guys were doing? in terms of making the customer first?
A lot of times customers would have, in a network environment, people would have challenges when things weren't working. Was it a hardware problem, a driver problem, a third-party problem? And you're using all these products. How do you figure out how to solve your problem? And if you take ownership of what the customer's problem is and don't worry about the fact that it might not be your problem as a provider, but putting them first, they remember that. And they will continue to purchase products from you because you are the person that was that go-to that helped them figure out what the heck was going on.
Yeah, and I think more importantly, right, with the tech space, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but back then with computers moving so quickly and the PCs coming on board and then the internet moving so fast and people just feeling like they can't get caught up, right? And now we're experiencing the younger generations are now feeling our pain because we've got AI coming on board and they're like, there's so much stuff and I can't keep up.
Yeah.
So those of us that were pre-internet are like, hey man, this is just part of the game with this stuff. But the younger kids seem to be a little so we'll talk about that later. So at what point did you realize you'd had enough? Like, was there a point where you said, you know what, I don't want to be an employee anymore. I want to be
It got to the point where there was a big migration. They were moving a lot of jobs to overseas.
Yeah.
And so it was a matter, not so much that I wouldn't have maybe stayed, but when you can see your whole department's being, you know, being moved out. I spent over a year training my replacements in another country and getting them on board of what they needed to do the job. And then at that point, I'm like, you know, I'm at a point in my career where I've seen everything that is good about business and what's bad. I want to go out there and try to do this on my own. Mm-hmm. And we started out wanting to build a SaaS company, but we got to pay the mortgage, right? So you got to do a lot of by the hour work still, consulting, projects for the people while you're building out your other, whether it be a SaaS or a service offering. We had recognized as we were going along that there was a great opportunity for us and a big code set change, biggest one in a long time, and they moved to what's called ICD-10. And so we put a lot of effort. We had a really warm market in the chiropractic space and sold, I mean, I don't know, 20,000 plus books to all them. So back in 9 years ago, we were a company that was 50% of revenue or more was books. Another half was software.
Wow.
So about 9 years ago, we had our full pivot where that was our first year in 2016, where we made more money selling software than books. And then we realized, okay, this is where the world's going. Where obviously people want content and we give people content the way they want it. And we said, well, we got great content in our books, but if people want to be on a computer, or they want to be on a handheld or whatever, let's go with the full SaaS and really push that hard and de-emphasize the book. So last year was our first year with no book sales.
Wow.
We faced that in the middle of last year. We're straight ARR type business now. Now, through all that, we had a couple other pivots along the way. The first million, it is the toughest because that's where you got to figure out, do I really have a business?
Yep.
And the first thing you got to do, in my mind, is you got to get to where you have three big customers. You get the first one, and then the way you get the second, the third one is to tell the second, third guys, well, we already have the first biggest customer. So, you know, obviously we can handle the scale. People are kind of afraid when you're smaller, can these guys handle me? Once you have those first three, then those can be a reference point for anyone else that says, well, I don't know, can you handle it? It's like, what do you mean? You guys are half the size of what we already have. Of course we can handle you guys. So that's the most important is to get those first couple. You may have some big ones that only have 1 to 5 customers to start with, but they're a big name. You're in a pilot program, but don't be afraid to put them on your website at the bottom saying, you know, we're with this company and this insurance company and this hospital and this government entity, because those are reference points that people will recognize.
So what are the challenges then of breaking past that? Obviously getting the first million is tough. And you know, as you heard at the beginning of the show here, like one of the things I've noticed with the people I've talked to over the years, and I'm probably, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 people now I've spoken to off just who've connected with me on LinkedIn. And I would say 85% of them are stuck in the $500,000 to $1 million a year business. So obviously getting there is good, but then there's guys getting stuck there. What's keeping people there? Like how do you break past $1 million into, like, let's say the 5 million? All right, that would probably be the next the market
to get
for
to
people.
1 to 3. From my experience, it was okay. There, when you first start out, you're wearing all the hats. You're the sole proprietor. You got 30 hats. You want to work hard enough to find that next person to bring on to do all the things that you don't like doing or don't do that well or just never get to, but you know that are important. Once you make enough money to cover that next guy or grow whatever, then you got that covered. Then you grow some more, make a little more money, then you bring on another person. But you're always working from that break even. This is the bootstrap methodology I used rather than the, you know, go get other people's money, because that has its own host of problems.
Sure.
And I felt that doing that would just get me back to being an employee again, because then I'm working for someone else's money to do what they want to have done. And I wanted the flexibility of being able to pivot. Even though it took longer, it allowed me more freedom and flexibility to do what I wanted to do next, where it would be a hard sell to sell to a board or a PE firm that wants results in 3 months. Maybe I want to build something that's going to take a year to build to make it right.
Sure. So what are the challenges you face then? Like, because obviously you're shifting from employee, and you know, I get that eventually you had the departments you were over, so the leadership was already kind of a skill there. But how did you face not being just the owner, but also the leaders? Like, so going from 1 million to 3 million, you've got new challenges now because you're bringing on teams, you're bringing on people. What did you do to, I guess, progress your skills to be able to manage that growth as a leader?
Well, the first thing we did, we went and brought on the people, and what happened was, there was too many bosses, too many people telling people what to do, and the organization wasn't there, because we still had this entrepreneurial attitude in our business, which is good. You need to have that drive to try new things. But we had a management problem. For us, what's worked really well is we bought that book called Traction.
Oh yeah,
Gino Wickman did.
Gino Wickman,
the entrepreneur system.
So are you a visionary or an integrator?
We decided between me and my business partner that we're both a hybrid.
Oh, so lucky you. I'm 100% visionary.
Okay. So I have got integrator stuff in my blood, and I'm also got visionary stuff. So we kind of came up with a 60-40 split and just said, okay, what are all the visionary things that I like to do? And I went, and then he said, well, I want to do those two. Cause oh, great. You do those good. You're good at figuring out, seeing the vision of the product. Okay. There, those are yours. Integrator. And then we divided up that, and it worked out good. So we came up with our hybrid model that work for her. So
oh, that's fantastic.
You know, when you look at your V and your I, you need to have someone else to go to, and they need to compliment you. It's better if they're not like with you. You can't have two visionaries straight doing it, because then nothing gets done, right?
Yeah, then all you have is a whole bunch of good ideas that are halfway finished.
So, and that doesn't work. Make sure you have a good business partner that compliments you. And when you finish rolling out your team, we got four more of the executives now, but as you build that team out, bring on people that are the types of people that can stand on their own two feet, know how to have been in other management roles in the past, know how to work with people is important, and make sure that the kind of people that can be adaptable. Because life, you know, you want, if you're going to work with people, you'd rather work with people that you like, right? Rather than people that are a hard problem. As long as you hire and fire on your core values, for us, it's Midas, which is means to an end, attitude, dependable, attitude, self-starter. As long as all those people fit, then it works. Mm-hmm. On that A attitude, what if you hire someone that just got a bad attitude, they cause cash in the organization, mess things up. It's not a right seat in the bus issue. They shouldn't be on the bus issue. And once you get your core values figured out, I know that seems kind of, most companies don't figure that out until they're kind of the way into it. But whatever you are, if you're between 500,000 and 5 million, if you haven't established those yet, then you need to get that nailed down. And your employees need to understand what they are too. It's not just a piece of paper that you talk about once. You know, you make it part of what your core company is, and people will rally around that. But we had about 3 million. We got stuck on that issue of our core values weren't really established right well, and we had too many employees that were taking instruction from three different managers, and they're like, okay, what am I supposed to do then? So it's better to get that nailed down and then get into your whole traction model. And that worked really well for us. And that,
well, it sounds like you also had the flexibility to get to a point where you're going, okay, this isn't working, and you weren't afraid to get in and restructure things.
Yeah, we had a consultant come in actually for 18 months and help us nail down at the executive level who we were and how to communicate with each other, and then say, okay, now we're going to bring on the employees and get them all engaged. And then as people come and go over time, then you just bolt them back in and help them understand what the system is. And I had one employee say, you know, he feels like he works for the unicorn, not a company, because there's not that many companies that really care about what their employees are doing and care about who they are and want to give them every Friday off. Well, I respect who they are and what they're doing. And as an employer, I don't want to have to when you have a complicated company with a whole bunch of SaaSes and a lot of products and tons of content, it's less work to just keep your people happy and make them feel part of the system and respect for who they are and what they can do than to retrain someone every year.
You know, and that brings up a good point. Like, we're also getting into this era where, you know, I call it the freelancer era. There are a lot of freelancers, but it's sort of the mentality of, and I, you know, going from Hollywood and being on salary and having daily office hours and everything, and I became a sales copywriter, and suddenly everything became project-based. And so I'm coming to somebody and I'm like, hey, I'm going to, you know, here's my fee for this project. You know, some of those projects I could get done in 10 hours, right? But I'm making a 30-day salary compared to my previous job. So for when I first started doing that, realizing that, oh, it's not necessarily about the time in the seat. It's about what actually gets done. And that's what's got me excited about as we're moving into the future now is creating opportunities for people to be able to go, like, you know, if you get everything you need to get done in a week and you want to take 2 days off because it's already done, like, fantastic, right? Who cares if you're in the seat or not, because everything that needed to be done is done. And that's the important thing. And I'm sure you've been there, right? You've worked with people that they don't care what you've got done. Did you put in your 40 hours? And you're like, did you put in your 40 hours and get nothing done? I don't care, but you were on the clock, yeah, 40 hours, right? So what led to the 4-day work week? I got asked. Seems pretty innovative, especially in the SaaS space.
Well, we looked at what we were doing, and you know, in the winters, sometimes you get to where people, they need a break, and they've got, a lot of people have families, and it gets cold, and they've got stuff to go, they've still got to get to the dentist and all that. And when we went remote, it was right around a little before then when we were starting to dabble with it. We did it as an experimental thing, a little at a time. And we would tell the employees, if we can achieve results and continue our growth, if you guys can work hard, then we can reward you. And the best way to reward someone is by giving them some time. Yeah, you still have salaries and all that stuff, but and salary increases and bonuses. That just inspired them, I think, to focus on less water cooler time, working together as a team, and make sure you have a good team software to pull that off. We started with, okay, Fridays, let's take half day off on Fridays. We're going to see if that affects us too much, because we saw our call volume from 1 o'clock on Fridays, at least in our industry, dip quite a bit. So that, you know what? What if we try, just see, does that affect? Because we're growing, as an employer, I can give you guys that because you've earned it this week. See how it goes. We'll try it for the summer. That worked. Then the next year, we said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to drop all Friday and go to 4/10. And then we saw how that worked, then moved it to 4/9, and now we moved it to 4/8. So we actually can give them, it's not just a 4/10, it's a 4/8. But
that's remarkable. Part of me is chuckling because I'm going, you doing it the way you did it was also because you're having to decondition Americans, because we're like, if I'm not working, I've noticed that's very much American, especially in the entrepreneurial space of like, I got to get my, you know, entrepreneurs are like, I'm part-time 60 hours a week. And it's like, but what if you could only work for 30? And this will be a good segue to what we were talking about earlier. I call him a kid. He's like probably 23, remarkable with AI stuff. And he's been talking about things I've not seen anyone else talking about, especially with AI. He said, look, here's what AI is going to be able to do. Here's where we're going with it. And he's like, AI is going to allow you to go from working 40 hours a week to working 30 hours a week. And he's like, and when that happens, stop working 40 hours a week. He's like, it's not that you now have 10 extra hours. He's like, the next week, once you figured out how to shave 10 hours off, he's like, I know this is going to be hard for you. He's like, take 5 hours off the next week and don't go back to, he'll only work 35 hours. And he's like, and so then when you can figure out how to go from, you know, 30 hours a week to 20 hours a week, only work 30. And I was thinking about that and I was going, that's really funny, because that was sort of the big, I'm going to call it the big lie of it, when smartphones came along and we started getting the internet, of like, look, how much more productive we are. We're going to be able to get 40 hours of work done in 20 hours. And everybody just shifted to like, well, I guess I'm just going to have to get 80 hours of work done now and 40 hours a week. Nobody stopped to go, well, let's just work the 20 hours, right? And so like, I feel in some ways you've helped to kind of decondition your employees to be like, it's okay to work 32 hours a week. It's okay.
You know what? It's something fun to shoot for. And of course, you know, we have to, for the few support calls or whatever, that for Fridays would be open, so the person that works Friday doesn't work Monday, but just detail. The idea is four days a week and all at the same time. One thing I wanted to add was, when you do that, it helps other people. It helps your whole family. You might have a situation where maybe if you've got a guy working for you, maybe he's married and his wife has a whole bunch of little kids, and she can use that day to do some things maybe she wants to do. So it really solidifies the whole family into your culture being part of it. And the cool thing about what AI is going to do, at least in our company, I've been in a mastermind for the last year, learning a lot of their technologies with Perplexity and Claude and Grok and all the different things. And to see the evolution over the last year or two, they're leapfrogging each other. One's better at one thing this week, and then next week, and then another guy just, you know, then Grok goes ballistic. And anyway, it's kind of hard to keep up. And I think, but what's good though, is we're finding tasks and things we can do in our company to make us more efficient. Data that I wanted to know to solve how I should move the company forward, I can find out quicker and my people can find out quicker. So the whole idea is the one guy I'll just share with you, wrote the book, it's an ingrained AI into your whole system is the idea, but you build your own governance in your company, make sure everyone's using the tools the same way, you know how to use them. And look throughout your organization, how can it be more effective? And if all my employees can be 20% more effective-ish, depends on what they're doing, then each individual is that more powerful and they can bring that much more to the table. And then as an employer, you're not having to hire maybe quite as many people, and maybe you're able to make better decisions about what to do next based on what you've learned. Something as simple as, here's this product I want to go ahead and either acquire or use. What is my total addressable market for that? And I can get that answer before it would take a week of research. I get that answer back in less than a minute. And while it may not be perfect, it's good enough to make a good data business decision.
I love it. So what are some of the changes you're seeing with AI in the SaaS space right now? I mean, because you've got multiple SaaS products across multiple domains. How is this stuff impacting what you guys are doing?
We're going to have different little pieces in our current products, as well as looking at developing other things as well. But what's interesting, if you go to a convention, you'll see all kinds of companies out there saying they can do AI this, AI that, and it's just AI all over the billboards. And it's almost kind of noisy.
Ridiculously noisy right now. It reminds me like 5 years ago when everybody was like, app. Everybody needs app. You got to have an app. You got an app.
Yeah, just go back in the last 20, 30 years. There's a buzzword or a buzz thing that comes out, and everyone, that's all they can ever talk about, and until the next exciting thing comes up. So right now, there's a little bit of that, and there's a little bit of Emperor's New Clothes kind of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. If I was at a convention just the other last week in Vegas, and just to walk around the floor, see the 100+ different people saying they had AI. But when you got down under the covers to actually look, you could see that's all that is. Or, you know, there's just kind of kludged. Some are using stuff from someone else that they've built, which isn't all the way done yet. But there's also some great concepts and technologies that it's making people look at that and say, how can we move forward with that? So there's a lot of money being thrown at it right now. What's interesting is if you find something, you go, that's just too expensive. I can't use AI because of the cost involved. If you look over the last 6 to 12 months, the cost, because there's so much competition in the AI space, is coming down every month. So if you do your business analysis saying it was too expensive, maybe it won't be in 3 months. My point is, I would look at those costs as being decreasing over time.
Sure. So, I mean, look, a year and a half ago, I was seeing guys, you know, $10,000-$15,000 to teach you to be a certified prompt engineer. Mm-hmm. And now we're to the point where you can just go to Claude or Grok and be like, okay, here's the result that I need. Help me write the prompt to get there. And then you go, okay, you're a prompt engineer. Analyze the prompt and give me a better prompt. And it gives it. And then you're just like, I don't even need to know that anymore. Just in a year and a half, that's already outdated. So
the things that drive people to make changes in software is hardware changes, software changes, government regulations also come into play.
Yeah,
where
it's pesky regulations get in the way.
You will all do this. You will all quit doing paper claims. You will all move to the electronic medical record. So that those a lot of times things get driven by the government. But what'll be interesting to see is as all the software improves, what'll happen is the hardware will get to the point where it's got to keep up. Then they'll make changes there, and there'll be another spike. But the reality is, the change is going to happen. It's going to keep changing and in this space. And be content with what you're learning and how you can use it. And what I sense, but no one wants to say, is people are a little unsettled because the change is moving faster and outside a window of human comfort. Because it's just, you know, how much smartness an AI bot would have just keeps exponentially growing every few months. And it's just, it's kind of a lot for us humans to ingest.
So from your seat, running the company, you are a CEO. What are you, over this next 3 to 5 years, what do you see as the big challenges for business leaders? And what do you see as the big opportunities?
I'd say the biggest challenges are understanding, you know, within the AI change, understand how the industry, if this kind of change is happening, how it affects you currently, how it affects your customers and what they're doing and what they might do in the future, and what opportunities does it present for you where you're already in industry and you already have your customers. Are you going to be part of their solution or are they going to have to go somewhere else? So I think being aware of what their needs are, and there'll be different industries that will evolve at different paces.
Sure.
But the important thing is to have an open mind to everything. And that's, as a business leader should do it, you should have a little bit of paranoid, like, what could work against me? What keeps me up at night is, okay, what do I have to do to move the company forward? Where's that next set of customers? How can I market better? How can I sell better? What are the deficiencies in my current product that the customers need that they are asking for? And what are they not asking for that they need? I think there needs to be a little bit more tightness with the company level to be comfortable with the customers you have and understand and build a good community with them so they feel a part of your growth and they want to be part of your community as they grow in solving their business needs. And if you can figure out how to make them more efficient, then they'll stick with you for a long time. I still remember one of my favorite quotes we had that used our product. This is over a decade ago. She said, "I used to do my job in 8 hours a day, but now with your new product, Find a Code, I can do it in 2 hours a day. Just don't tell my doctor because I like the extra 6 hours of free time I have." I'm not saying that's what you should have done with the 6 hours, but find ways to make your product so efficient that your people become more productive and they can do other things with their time.
I love it. So, that's great advice.
And always be inquisitive. Always look for the next problem to solve. Be aware that the government may change regulations. And if they do, how fast can you move? How fast can you create a new product? You know, we had findacode.com for a long time. And then there was this big push for value-based care instead of fee-for-service. And that became what HCC Coder is. And that's used by many insurance companies today as they figure out what's that right amount of, how sick the patients are, how many comorbidities they have, what's the right amount to be reimbursed for the illness of that set of patients. So we provided another tool because of new regulations that were, you know, and requirements that were happening in that industry. So
let's wrap this up. This is all great advice. Thank you so much. So Inovi Health, somebody's listening to this. They like the values you guys. Who's like the perfect fit for Inovi Health and the suite of products you guys run?
I would say coders, billers, auditors are the top three. The next tier of ones I see leading it are nurses, lawyers, doctors, researchers, and those role type and practice managers. Anyone that's involved with that whole RCM space, making sure that the right amount of money is going between point A and point B based on what set of codes, and are those sets of codes right? And then when they change over time, we have all those current data in our system to deal with that.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right, I like to end every conversation with three personal questions. So here we go. It's off the top of your head. If you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of advice, what would it be and why?
I think I'd probably tell myself to relax a little bit and maybe not be so intense about a lot of the little things. If you get too worked up about the things that don't matter to your business, it keeps you away from doing the most important things in growing your business. So if you have any perfectionism tendencies, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you've got to squash those. You got to be okay with things being 80% good enough, or good enough that the customer is going to be happy. Not that you'll be happy, but that the customer's happy. And if you build your products around the customer's needs, not your perfectionism, I think excessive perfectionism is the biggest disease to progress in an entrepreneurial company.
You know what's interesting is that also applies in the book space, because on my third book, I had a fairly big publisher picked it up. And you know, so I was like super hyper aware of everything. This book's got a publisher, I got a beer. Yeah. So I hired like 5 editors. I had 15 of my friends read it and mark it all up. And then the editor had 2 editors go through it. And then we published it. And in the first 5 pages, I caught 3 typos. And I was like, 35 people looked at this manual. And then the first 5 pages, And after that, I realized no matter what I do, the book will never be perfect. I have to get to the, and so my mantra now when I'm writing is when on my second or third edit, I will go, is this good enough to get out and go? And if I can say yes, I will like, I will let the typos I know are going to be found in there. I got to let them go so we can move on.
I have seen so many products. I mean, prior to our business back in the Novell days where there were products that they wanted to get perfect too much to the point where it was keeping the product from getting out the door.
They would never launch.
And I think any software company struggles with that. But just make sure that your customers are going to be happy. And then you can be adding. And I think the iterative approach to software is a lot better than try to get a big bunch of things all together working at the same time. Just build and build and pivot, build and build.
So what belief or mindset shift has had the biggest impact on your success and your happiness?
I think the biggest mindset probably is to look at myself and look at my own tendencies and recognize when I'm doing something where I can do it and allowing, taking that off my plate and say, okay, I'm hiring you to do this job. Take a little bit of a laissez-faire approach to it and just say, you go build it your way and then report back how it's going. And then be okay if it doesn't go maybe as you want it to do. Allow people will want to work for you if they don't feel like they're being micromanaged, but yeah. They're given a general direction and then they can bring their own style and their own personality into the building out a department or solving a particular business problem. It doesn't have to be solved all your way. You got to, for anyone who's stuck at a million, you got to let go. You got to let go of the reins and you got to share the love.
But it's so hard.
Yeah, you got to let go, man. You got to take a laissez-faire approach, not to lose control to where the company's not moving forward. But maybe how you would do things, you lose control of a little bit. That's how you switch from being a sole proprietor to being a business owner. And then when that happens and you have solid people running your business, then you can be even more strategic and go create new partnerships and do more new acquisitions and find out where you should be. I think the biggest thing I've learned is by being stuck down in the weeds, you can't see the forest for the trees. And the opportunity cost is all the things that you lose because you're so focused on being down in the business instead of working on your business.
Yeah, no, I love it. All right, final question is, what's the best investment you've ever made in yourself?
I would say starting a business. It's like a master's degree in everything that they never teach you in school. And there's no way you can learn it in a book. You have to be thrown into the water and sink and see how adaptable you can actually be. And then be at that point where you question, why did I even start this? When I started doing what I do now, I thought, well, this would be a nice little thing to do for, you know, a year or two. And then before you know it, you just keep building and building and building. And before you know it, it turns into the rest of your career. Be content with the journey. Don't worry about the destination because the destination is not what you envision. It's what your customers are envisioning it for you to be.
I've discovered from my own experiences, generally when I'm let go of things and I'm just open into universe, God source, universal consciousness, whatever you want to call it. I have big ideas and big plans and big goals. And there's not been a single time when I've let go that I haven't ended up somewhere where I'm like, this is so far beyond what I thought I would do.
Right.
It's just like, well, I'm like, why did I spend all those years trying? I'm like, it's got to be my way. And then when I finally let go, I was like, oh, wow, I ended up at a spot that was way better than what I could even imagine I would get to. Yeah. So,
I mean, there's a real thing to that whole, you know, that manifest type attitude where you manifest where you're going to go and you have a vision of where it should be. And that's what gets you there. But you need to be okay, content with the journey along the way to that general direction and enjoy it.
Yeah. I love it. Well, Lamont, thank you so much for your time. This has been a fantastic conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, been fun. Happy to chat in the future. If you have another questions about how to build a 40 work week or someone wants to talk to me about how that's done down to the granular level.
What's the best way for someone to connect to you? LinkedIn?
Probably just LinkedIn. Yeah. There's not a lot of Lamont Levitts out there. There's one doctor in the California.
That's funny.
Yeah. Lamont Levitt on LinkedIn would be great. I'm probably the best way to find me. Or my email is lamont.levitt@inovihealth.com.
All right.
BIHealth.com.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, man.